reimagine or reinvent what the image of God is for us, not only taking that which we have been given from the scriptures, but also taking that which we get from our understanding of life, our understanding of personal experience, our understanding of our earth, our understanding of the universe. I am a geologist. I come from Minnesota. Yes, there is geology in Minnesota. But I've been a geologist for about 15 years. I've been a Christian all my life. And as I have gotten more into geology, it's impossible not to have those two things converse with each other. That my Christianity has influenced the way that I see geology and do geology, and my geology has influenced the way that I see my faith. I need to close the door. Oh, he's got it. Thank you. I want to show or underline today that we are connected to the earth in several different ways. It's a word that you hear a lot at a place like Holden, connectedness. But it's a great word. And I think certently in lieu of our present environmental crises on the planet, we need to regain some of our sense of our own connectedness to be empowered to do the work that needs to be done to alleviate some of these environmental problems. Now that would be important in itself, but I want to suggest also that we are connected in deeper ways, in an aesthetic sense and a spiritual sense. And our disconnectedness not only brings about ecologic problems, but it also brings about spiritual problems. We get, I like the theological term estrangement. We are estranged from the soil, from the earth, from our origins on this planet. And so I want to talk about those connections and somewhat of our disconnectedness. I also want to present a story or an idea where we are not moved to be reconnected with the earth out of a sense of shame or guilt. We're so bad, we need to heal the planet, but more out of a sense of desire, a sense of love for the planet, a sense of passionate reunion with our nature, with our origins. So what I want to talk about here is three points that I want to make. The first one is that the Earth is alive. It's a dynamic planet. It's moving. It's alive in a figurative sense, poetic sense. But some people suggest it's also alive in a very literal sense. I don't happen to believe that, but it's a beautiful image. The second idea I want to talk about is to re-envision ourselves as geologic events. That as much as the Earth has created oceans and volcanoes and rocks and glaciers, it has also created life, ecosystems, birds, you and me. We are a feature of our planet. We are one thing that our planet does. And then the last thing I want to talk about are some of the spiritual dimensions of that. I think you can already see that there are some spiritual dimensions to this. But like a lot of the things that we're being challenged by this week, there are aspects of whether it be looking at sexuality. Last week we were looking at blending Christianity with world religions. Or it might be looking at the scriptures in a new sense through the eyes of historical criticism. All of these things are very challenging to us. And there is one thing that's hard about them is that there is this promise of beauty in reimagining God this promise of wholeness, but there's also a lot of other disturbing things that come along with us. And sometimes it's safer just to say, no, I'm just going to stick with the Bible and just, I'm just going to believe in that. Even though there's this promise of wholeness out here, I don't want to risk this threat of alienation or whatever it is. I believe that it is the Spirit of God that is moving us towards this promise, to this, through this re-envisioning. So let me talk about these three points here. Any questions right at this moment? Okay, this is the geology part, this first part here. I should put in a plug here for the Portal Museum. One way to be reconnected with the Earth is to become friends with it again, refamiliarize yourself with what the Earth is like. Up at the Portal Museum, up on the second level, is a wonderful museum and a number of programs given during the week on the character of our planet, from volcanoes to plate tectonics to glaciers, all kinds of things. So, get thee to a museum. The Earth is alive. The Earth is alive. The Earth is constantly in motion. We are very limited by our human senses to know this. I think people that are in their 50s and 60s know this a little bit better, because you can come back to a place that you were at as you were a child and say, oh, look at that tree. I remember when it was that high, you know. You can't see trees growing, but after you come back for a long time, you can. If our lifespan were a little bit longer, let's say 100 or let's say 1,000 years or 10,000 years, we could come back to Railroad Creek Valley here and say, ah, gee whiz, I remember when there were glaciers here. It was really nice then, lots of snow, ice. And I remember when that, when Copper Peak used to be this tall, and now it's a little bit shorter, you know. These are things that you can only see if we had these long time spans. We can't see the dynamism that's in the Earth because of these limitations. Certainly we can see volcanoes, earthquakes, but quite literally every spot on the Earth's surface is in some kind of change all the time. Whether it be changes in the soil, erosion of a silt grain, slowly rebounding after the weight of glaciers has left it, the Earth is constantly in motion. Not only in a horizontal sense, but also in a vertical sense, but also in a horizontal sense. One of the most beautiful pictures of the dynamism of our planet has come about just in the last 20, 30 years. And I'm speaking of a theory known as plate tectonics. Some of you, if you were at the session Saturday night, heard about this. Plate tectonics is the grand new theory in geology that explains everything. Geologists love this because rather than being a collection of disparate fields, people studying earthquakes, people studying glaciers, people studying mud flows, people studying brachiopods in the Cambrian, here is one idea that ties everything together. No matter what area of research you're working on, you can always come back and put it in a plate tectonic context. And what does that mean? Plates, plate tectonics. Plates refer to the fact that the Earth has a shell, a crust, not unlike the shell of an egg, broken into around a dozen pieces. Imagine dropping an egg out of the refrigerator. It goes into a dozen pieces. This is what the Earth is like. The thickness of the shell is not unlike the thickness of the crust. These shell fragments move around on the planet. They move around about as fast as your fingernails grow. The next time you clip your fingernails, you can think about us getting a centimeter away from Great Britain every year. We are constantly in motion. It's in motion because beneath these, the shell or the crust of the Earth, is a material that is, I think I said it was kind of like toothpaste the other day. It's kind of like toothpaste. In that it's not solid, it's not really liquid. It might be 10% liquid and 90% solid or something. But anyway, it gives, it moves. It moves like your oatmeal on the stove in the morning, or your sun tea. It has these convection cells in it. And as these convection cells move, by some process, it's transferring this motion to these plates. And those plates are shifting about on the planet. And this is why they explain everything. All the action takes place at the boundaries between these plates, at where these interplatal relationships. The eggshells here can do three different things relative to each other. They can split apart, they can come together, they can slide side by side. And depending on which kind of boundary you have, and those are the only three possibilities, it makes all the difference. For example, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is a place where they come apart. And right at that crack where they come apart, up wells one of these convection cells, new magma comes up, and at that crack, the ocean floor is made. The ocean floor is about 75% of the Earth's surface. Every piece of ocean floor has a history dating back to being at a boundary where it was created. After it's made, this continues to split apart. New stuff comes up, continues to split apart. So it's kind of like two conveyor belts moving away from each other. So the whole 75, I mean, this is what you can kind of get an idea why geologists think it explains everything. If you can explain all the ocean floors by happenings at this crack, that's explaining a lot. Well, what is the other 25% of the world? It's the continents. Most of the continents, or almost all the continents, you can relate back to places where these plates came together. Now, this is where geology gets kind of messy. This is kind of like the geology we're living in right now, Holden Village. As plates come together, a piece of the ocean floor commonly dives beneath. It's thin, it's dense, it's heavy, it kind of sags in the toothpaste. And it tends to be shunted below this light, thick, balsa-like continent. The continents are actually a little bit lighter than the ocean floors. And as this material goes underneath, there's all kinds of things that happen at this freeway pileup at that point. There is pressure, high temperatures, volcanoes, magma coming up, explosive volcanoes. That's where this place right here is kind of a continental factory. This is where the material that makes up the crust that we sit on is made. This crust goes down for about 50, 70 miles. Even in Minnesota, the rock, I live in St. Peter, not far from there is Morton, Minnesota. Morton used to be famous because it had the oldest rock in the world. It's 3.1 billion years old. And now they found something older in Greenland, they say. No, they do. It's true. It's older in Greenland. But even that rock in the center of the continent, far away from our plate margins, at one time was at a plate margin, and its character is made by, it was determined by these plates coming together. So 75% of the Earth is made by places where plates come apart, and you have this dense, thick basalt ocean floor. And the other is where they come together, where we have this freeway pile up. Magmatism, metamorphism, all kinds of things happen there. It's messy, but it's neat. So that is, so volcanoes occur at places where plates have boundaries. Earthquakes, the plates moving by each other, that's an earthquake. Mountain ranges, where we have this collision. The Andes, the Rockies, the Aleutians, the Himalayas, the Alps, all of these are mountain ranges built up at plate boundaries. So it explains why we have mountains. It explains why the continents are the shape they are. It explains, to some degree, why there are certain fossils on one continent and not another. It explains why we have the climate that we do in some sense. It's dry in eastern Washington because plate tectonics has thrown up the Cascades and blocked all the rain. So, plate tectonics is associated with climate change, which is wonderful. Everything ties back to this. It's been around for 25 years, and most of the evidence that has come up since then just supports this wonderfully, often by disparate paths. When you have an idea that you prove that you support by one line of logic and another line of logic and another line of logic, you tend to think that that's true. So the earth is alive in this kind of figurative sense, always in motion. Rivers flowing, plates moving, glaciers flowing, the atmosphere moving, trees growing, the earth is alive. I mentioned that some people think that in a rather literal sense the earth is alive. There is a hypothesis called the Gaia hypothesis. Has anybody heard of that before? The Gaia hypothesis. That would be the Gaia, the goddess of the earth, parts of the, I don't know much about the Gaia hypothesis, but parts of it deal with the fact that the earth appears to be as a living organism. That the ecosystems present on the surface, the rainforest, the prairies, whatever, the organisms that make those up, work together to kind of set and maintain, like a thermostat in a room, the temperature of the atmosphere, the temperature of the oceans, the composition of the atmosphere. If there are some kind of changes, like a period of intense volcanic activity or a change in our distance from the sun, those changes will be not so much predicted but responded to by organisms to make sure the earth doesn't get too warm or get too cold. It's got this buffering system that maintains. And geologic evidence suggests that this has been happening for at least a billion years, if not longer, that the ocean and the atmosphere has been pretty much in a steady state, in the same kind of character. Other people would go so far to say that, in a very literal sense, the earth is an organism. And as cells are to our body, we organisms are to this larger organism called the planet. Whether or not this is true, I think is a wonderful image for thinking of how we fit in with the rest of the earth, the rest of the planet. That we are in cooperation, even though that on a day-by-day level, nature is competitive within itself. The whole earth is maintained and survives and grows and expands and evolves in a cooperative sense. It's a very beautiful notion. Okay. Any questions at this point? That's point one. The earth is alive. Okay. Point two. I want you to reimagine yourself as a geologic event. Next time a volcano goes off, you go, I'm just like that. I'm a geologic event. The reason why is that it seems that the things I'm going to talk about now come from science, and maybe I don't think I'm stretching them too much, but I'm using these scientific ideas in a very poetic sense. But from research done in geology, in physics, in chemistry, it seems like the universe wants to be alive. That matter, in some sense, desires to be alive. That the universe wants life. Some suggestions of this. Most physicists now believe in the Big Bang theory and have done so for the last 25 years or so. The Big Bang theory says that the universe is around 15 billion years old, started from a point of incredible heat, incredible mass, and the entire universe, which is 30 billion light years across, that's large, expanded from that point. and that the universe has evolved and is still expanding and evolving from that time. There is incredible evidence supporting that fact, that idea, that theory. And we can talk a little bit about the nature of science here. Some people are uncomfortable with the idea that the Earth is 15 billion years old, and on that, that the universe is 15 billion years old, and on that scale, humans are occupy, if the universe was a year long, we'd be a few hours on the last day or something. I mean, there's some spiritual consequences to that. What kind of creator is so, you know, he's really saving it for the end, you know. But we'll talk more about that in a second. But it seems in the first few milliseconds, literally, of the Big Bang, there were some choices made, or they appear as choices. Atoms, electrons, protons, the speed of light, all these things were not givens at the Big Bang. In the milliseconds that happened after the Big Bang, somehow the size of a proton was decided upon, the size of an electron, the charge of an electron was decided upon, the speed of light was decided upon. There is nothing inherent in their nature to say that they have to be that size, that charge, speed of light has to be that, the Planck constant has to be this or what. I mean, there's a bunch of things, very specific things. There was a whole range of options, and they went through this narrow window of possibility. And that narrow window, if the atom size were just a hair different, or the charge were just a hair different, life as we know it would not be possible. It seems like there was a needle through which thread of life was sent. The downside of that is, you know, if it had gone somewhere else, we wouldn't be here to reflect on that. But of all the possibilities, you know, in other words, it had to have gone that way for us to be here. But of all the zillions of possibilities, it went that way. Chemists say that looking at the structure of organic molecules, those are what make up life, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen compounds, that the geometry and the nature of those atoms are such that they fit perfectly together. They like, I'm anthropomorphizing here, they like to be together. There's a very stable kind of arrangement. To be more poetic, they yearn to be together. They just kind of fall together. They're just natural for being together. From geology, there seems to be some evidence that life as we know it on this planet has been around for about 3 billion years. But it wasn't until a half a billion years ago or more that there were really complicated forms. So 3/4 of the Earth's history was marked by very simple single-celled organisms. But there is some evidence that during the first billion years of the Earth's history, there was so much meteor activity that life was trying to rear its head all this time, trying to develop and being kind of sent back down to zero again. That it was trying to get started, but it had all these meteor catastrophes. Again, the Earth seems to want to be alive. We are, matter yearns for life. We are not only the gleam in our parents' eyes, but a yearn in the electrons in a quartz crystal. Matter has wanted us for a long time. The Earth is not merely a convenient, fertile garden that God has made and then put us on it so that we could live happily. We are sprung out of the soil, sprung out of the oceans. Some people take this to be a very different role than for humans on this planet. Rather than being seeing the Earth merely as utilitarian, if we have this reconnected view, there's another way that we can look at the Earth. This is a fine book that's really soft in terms of science in some ways, but it's a beautiful story about our relationship with the universe, or a beautiful idea. The Universe is a Green Dragon by Brian Swimming. He's a physicist. He's now associated with the Center for Creation Spirituality, Matthew Fox. He says our role, the universe has created us so that we can take joy in the universe, that we can have eyes and ears and a mind that reflects and sees Earth and says, you are beautiful, or we are beautiful, that this is our role, to take joy in the creation. Let me just read a section of this. The elements were bestowed on us by the stars. Complicated elements or heavier elements in your bodies were made in star explosion. That's the only way in the universe that they can be made. So when the Woodstock song says we are stardust, that's quite literal. Our atoms can only be made in stars. The complex compounds given to us by the young Earth, the informed sequences of the genes by microorganisms, our DNA evolved from other organisms, our limbs and organs by advanced life forms, the linguistic symbols carrying our thoughts and feelings by the human venture. All our aspects of our body are inherited from an evolutionary history. We could not see without the work of those who shaped the eye, could not hear without the work of those who shaped the ear. The universe created these gifts, lavishing them upon us. Our first and deepest response is infinite gratitude. That which created all of this now desires our creativity, commitment, and labor, our delight in entering with full awareness of the cosmic story. The mountains and oceans, stars and life forms, all recipients of the same generosity, contributors to the unknown future culminations of our work, all tremble with the same power. And that's why I condense our contemporary cosmological scientific story of reality by saying that the universe is a green dragon. Green because the whole universe is alive, an embryogenesis beginning with the cosmic egg of the primeval fireball, the Big Bang, and culminating in the present emergent reality. And a dragon too, nothing less. Dragons are mystical, powerful, emerging out of mystery, disappearing in mystery, fierce, benign, known to teach humans the deepest reaches of wisdom. And dragons are filled with fire. Though there are no dragons, we are dragon fire. We are the creative, scintillating, searing, healing flame of the awesome and enchanting universe. So rather than being merely relegated to the last few hours of the cosmic year, rather than being relegated to this eensy-beensy planet in this 30 billion light year, rather than our response being our insignificance, he would say that we should with joy respond to being a part of this incredibly wonderful, huge, bizarre universe. Let me go on and talk about the last section. I think I'm already drawing some spiritual dimensions into this, or some ideas that are different from the biblical story of creation. All this makes me feel more connected with the earth, wanting to be connected with the earth. When I think this way, it makes me feel more earthy. It makes me think I'm natural. A lot of the energy in the environmental movement seems to come from guilt. We're ruining the planet. It's our fault. Now I feel like I'm natural. What I do is natural. Building a house is natural. Building even cars and roads is natural in some sense. The question becomes one of sustainability. That we shouldn't apologize for the kinds of things that we do. Birds build nests, beavers build dams, mud wasps build things. We're builders. We do these things. Those things we already do are natural. It also makes the flip side of that coin, it makes the earth seem more human, more familiar. I'm like these trees. We have the same atoms. We have the same energy flowing through us. The earth is our mother, brothers and sisters in the soil. Which brings me to the question then, if there's all this gloriousness about being connected to the earth, and it makes for wholeness within ourselves and within the planet, why are we disconnected. What is it that has brought our disconnection? And a lot of people have written about this, and there's several different themes here. I think one that I haven't heard enough, but that resonates true with me, is that I read a book several years ago by Ernst Becker called The Denial of Death. And Becker says that our society, our character, our culture, mortality by experiencing our naturalness, our physicality. We don't want to admit that we're going to die. Our minds, we feel like we are as God, that we are going to be eternal. I don't want to die. And the decaying, rotting earth, my bodily functions all remind me that I'm going to die. And I'm abhorred at that. So I want to deny everything that suggests my physicality. I think we talked about eroticism last night. This could be related, or I would say definitely related to our feeling about the erotic, but certainly our feeling about the earth, that we are somehow different from the earth. Man and nature. Humans and nature. Where we separate those two. Just as an aside, I think it's quite natural to separate us from the rest of nature, though. We often feel bad about being separate from nature, but I think tigers probably think of tigers and everything else. I think tigers probably don't think about polluting the earth, or I think they just are. And they don't care about lions or monkeys. They care about their young. They're going to kill anything that gets in the way. So I think there is something natural about our being speciesist, being liking humans. I mean, that's part of the natural design. But again, that can be taken a little bit too far. Well, I think if we see ourselves different from nature, there is a positive way to see ourselves different from nature, but we usually take a couple of negative routes. One is that we're above nature, better than nature, and the other that we're below and worse than nature. The first one I like to call kings and queens of creation. We are above everything. Yeah. You know, the earth is below us. We've been given the charge in the Bible that we are to, the earth is ours. We're to subdue the earth. I saw Chuck Colson once on the 700 Club. Just, you know, going through the channels, I wasn't really watching the 700 Club. And they were talking about predictions of geologists and other scientists that we're going to run out of oil and, you know, the middle of the next century, which are most of what the predictions are like. And they were kind of chuckling, these people, oh, those of little faith, they don't realize that God is going to inject more oil in the earth for us, and God would not abandon us. And this is this kind of notion to a perverse degree. There's also a little bit of a condescending nature when we emphasize the word steward. In one sense, we should, but to say, don't worry, God, we're going to take control here. We're going to fix everything up. We're going to fix the environment. And there's a little bit of pretension there as well. We need to see ourselves apart, and we need to fix things. We need to clean our house, but we can't paint ourselves as saviors of the planet. In fact, I don't like this phrase, it's time to save the planet. The planet doesn't, I mean, as I said before, I think the universe desires life. If we wipe ourselves out with a nuclear war or with environmental catastrophe, the universe will create life again. There'll be something else. It's not so much saving the planet as saving our species. And certainly there's something aesthetically pleasing and spiritually important about saving other ecosystems on the planet. But there'll be other ecosystems. There have been mass extinctions. We're going through a mass extinction right now. The rate at which we're killing animals is the same rate as when the meteors wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. We're going through a mass extinction. The Earth has had mass extinctions before. No problem. We'll just make more species. So let's not be so prideful and think we are going to save the planet. the planet can take care of itself. Thank you. So, there is that one sense that we're above nature. The other sense that you hear, not as often, but you do hear from some people, is that we are, I like to call, God's boo-boos. That we somehow, God was doing great, had this great earth, wilderness, everything was in harmony, and made a mistake, made people. When you go into a wilderness area and are upset when you see a shoe print, you know, oh shoot, ruined my wilderness experience. I think this is out of balance. We are natural. God made us. God doesn't make junk. God made the world. We're a part of it. We're just as much part of it as any other species. And again, maybe even have a unique role as all creatures would have. I think one of the great tasks of our generation is getting back to a more even, a more middle position on what it means to be people in nature. And I think we can get a lot from, though this is the story that a geologist might tell about creation is different from what the Bible tells. I think we need to underscore that the Bible does say things like that creation is good, and that it is whole, and that we are a part of it. I think I take those things out of the Genesis story, and these are gifts of God. Do you have any comments, or you want a little bit more?
What is the geologist's explanation of creation?
Well, it's long and beautiful and complicated.
Okay.
And our Earth, the cosmologists, those physicists that study the heavens, have given us the story of the Big Bang. And our solar system was created rather late in the creation of the universe. We're kind of a late solar system, late bloomers. It might mean that there are other solar systems, other places where there has been intelligent life created, and they've wiped themselves out, and all kinds of, that might have happened. One of my favorite things about the movie Star Wars was this the first line in it that said, long ago in a galaxy far away, there was this advanced civilization, but it happened a long time ago. I mean, these things can happen. Anyway, the Earth came along late in that, and it's a complicated story. And what's interesting about the history of the Earth, too, that it seems to have an evolution, that the very early Earth was different from the Earth of 3 billion years ago, which is different from the Earth of 1 billion years ago. There are many processes that are continuous and happen, like the winds and the rivers and volcanism, but there is also a change through time. So the Earth itself has an evolution, a growth. There will be one time when it will use up the energy that drives plate tectonics. There'll be a time when the sun uses up its energy. This is several billion years away. We have nothing really to worry about. There are some, what I'd say, some troubling notions from geology. I think what I've tried to do, most of the things I've said, I've wanted to hold up as something that was beautiful and whole and a promise. But there are some also troubling notions that continue to gnaw at me that come from a geologist. Some of these are kind of beautiful too, but one of the ideas is that if the planet is whole, in terms of being good at every given point in history. So that when it wasn't like the universe was waiting around, you know, this is kind of neat in the Precambrian, but gee whiz, wait till the late Cenozoic and you're going to have these humans, and then it's really going to be neat here. No, I would say at each stage, the universe was whole. If God sees when the sparrow falls, God saw when the brontosaurus fell. That sounds kind of corny to say that, doesn't it? But, I mean, I think God loved those creatures, and it was a whole planet, and it was good at that time. Buckminster Fuller, who was must reading when I was in college, in his operating manual for Spaceship Earth, has a couple of rewritings of the Lord's Prayer at the very end. And one of them, he refers to God as the evolutionary integrity unfolder. When I was at Augustana, the pastor there was kind of into Buckminster Fuller, and we had Augustana Campus Church, and we were going to rename it the Lutheran Church of the Evolutionary Integrity Unfolder. The idea is that our creation is in process, in evolution, and it every time it is integrated, it is whole, and God is that which unfolds this, that the earth is becoming. Some other ideas that are a little bit more troubling. Our Christian religion has places a lot of importance on death, that in the story of Christ, Christ's death on the cross redeems us, and also that there is some implication that because of Christ's act, we will not die. Death is an evolutionary feature. There used to be a time when animals didn't die. The earliest organisms reproduced asexually. So there are organisms now that potentially are extant from the beginning of life. They haven't died. For some reason, it was more beautiful, more good for creation to develop death. Another idea that's a little troubling, perhaps, is that extinction is quite a natural process. In the same way death is a good natural process, extinction is a natural process. Extinction doesn't happen. It does happen because an animal no longer is adapted or a plant no longer adapted to that environment. But if you look back at the history of geologic time, every species has an average life expectancy of around 10 million years. Some have lasted longer, some have lasted less. We've only been around for 4 million years. But there seems to be a rhythm, an organic cycle to evolution, that species have their time and they go, and species have their time and they go. So, what does this mean for the future? That our species, at one time, will be, whether or not we wipe ourselves out environmentally, nuclear war, our species will be destined to be not part of this place. And there'll be some other species after us that God loves, that's maybe intelligent. Another troubling idea. I mentioned that I think most geologists now think it's a very good explanation for the extinction of the dinosaurs that they were hit by a meteor hitting the Earth, or meteors. They think they've even found the place where one of them hit, in the Yucatan. There's lots of neat evidence for it. It's the kind of idea that geologists, we grow up not wanting to like, because it has this fantastic, catastrophic story. Geologists generally don't like those things. They want things to be normal. Because it's actually inherited from a time when people believed in the Bible that the Earth was only 6,000 years old, and this meant that everything had to happen in big catastrophes. So the first task of geology was to say, no. Those catastrophes don't work. Things are happen steadily. And now, so there's some reluctance for geologists to go back to this. But it's really exciting because there's a lot of evidence for it. Some geologists thought, well, if meteors killed the dinosaurs, I wonder if they killed any of the other animals. And they look back through the record at times when there were mass extinctions. And there's difference of opinion on this. But one way to read the data is that not only have meteors caused other extinctions, but that they happen regularly, around every 30 million years. So here is a wonderful planet that God loves. God loves life. And every 30 million years, here comes a meteor, and most of the species go extinct. There's always some that go through. Cockroaches, those kinds of things. So what is this? It seems like a clumsy universe. You know, oh, excuse me, I didn't see you had life there. It's, you know, what kind of universe is this where we have these accidents? One last thing. Stephen Jay Gould who is probably the leading evangelist of evolution. If you haven't read any Stephen Jay Gould, you should. He's just a wonderful writer in general. But some of the themes that he likes to promote are disturbing as well. One is that evolution is not progressive. That evolution, we are not the, okay, I'll believe in evolution, but like we're the high point, aren't we? Now he would say no. I mean, that evolution is kind of bumpy, chancy, and we are as much a product of chance, gracious chance, as clams or trees or something. Again, certain things could have gone another way back in history and something else would have developed. He also says that our consciousness, the ability that Brian Swimmey says it was yearned for by the universe so that we could reflect on how beautiful we are, the universe is. Stephen Jay Gould said that that may be totally an accident. When you build these massive supercomputers, you build them for a purpose. And then you find out, oh golly, they can do all this other stuff that you couldn't predict that they'd be able to do. Our brains, Gould would say, are similar in that they've been made more complex for certain adaptive reasons, but our brains are so large, so efficient, so capable of doing wonderful things that as a consequence or as a side benefit, we became conscious. We had this ability to reflect. There's no adaptive goal in that. That's his viewpoint. All these ideas are disturbing. I think I just need to say, because I've thought about these ideas for a long time, and I always feel a need to say something that I'm a confessing Christian and worship and a belief in Christ and God are as central to my life as anything could be. But I think God presents us with this information about the creation. And it's not all, like I said, a lot of it is beautiful, but a lot of it is disturbing too. And we kind of still have to trust that we will never be separated from the love of God. I think, as again, Berger Pearson last week said, faith is a risk. And I think this is the kind of places that you can go if you are faithful. All right, I don't have any more notes, so now we have to talk. Yeah.
Do you think there's sufficient evidence to say that we're really from this planet?
We're from this planet? There is, it's not only fossil evidence that ties us evolutionarily with other plants and animals. It's also biochemical evidence. Our genetic makeup is almost identical to chimpanzees. And you can create this web of life where you can show the relationships that creatures have with one another. You can create this tree of life by just looking at the genes. Again, that's,
That could be true in other parts of the universe.
That could be true in other parts of the universe. But you then relegate the question of origin of life to somewhere else. There is so much evidence for life starting on this planet that you don't need it to come from somewhere. It may have come from someplace else and started on here. And then, I mean, there are people have discovered amino acids in interstellar space. Is that life? Maybe that was part of the original stuff. And so our development of proteins and life came out of those that were part of the original planet. Even more so,
it doesn't make a difference too much if we didn't somehow originate someplace else. I mean, it seems to almost fit better in biblical sense to me. But
Well, if I like this idea of the universe wanting life, you know, saying life originated somewhere else is still saying that there is one source of life in the universe that's coming out and seeding all these planets, rather than coming out of creation itself. There was a cosmologist that did some rough figuring on how many planets there might be in the universe that have life, similar to ours. And there's a way that you can estimate that by looking at the size of our sun and the age and kinds of planets we have around here, and assuming that that's probably similar to other places in the universe. So you look at all the galaxies in the universe, and there's something like, we're in the Milky Way galaxy. There's something like 10 billion galaxies in the known universe, each with 10 to 100 billion stars. And if you look at all the stars that would be about the same size as the sun, that might have the same kind of planets, and you put that all together, you come out with a number with how many planets there might be in the known universe that have life like, could have life like us. And then this guy said, well, what if I'm wrong? What if I'm wrong by 1,000 times? I used the analogy last week, like, what if you thought you had $10 in your pocket and you opened up and you go, oh, I got $10,000. I mean, what I'm saying is a very conservative estimate to say, let's take my number divided by 1,000 just in case I've made some mistakes. Once you do that, you come up with 10 million. Huh. That there are 10 million planets in the universe. So it's the probability that there isn't life in the rest of the universe is astonishingly small. There's not evidence for life in the universe, but the probability is just overwhelmingly high that there must be life somewhere else in the universe. And, yeah.
At the time of the meteor that hit the Earth and the dinosaurs disappeared, do geologists also feel that there may have been something such as a polar shift or that, I'm thinking of when they found woolly mammoths or whatever that appeared to be frozen instantaneously?
Polar shifts are a natural thing on the planet. They're not really catastrophic. They do happen, and the last one happened about 700,000 years ago. It happened when our ancestors were around. And they're quite natural. They happen every few hundred thousand years. They're quite natural. And they're presumably due to changes in the currents in the core of the Earth. There's a molten core. That's liquid, and that generates our... It's always wondered me, though, that there doesn't seem to be a lot of ecological havoc created when the poles do shift. And they shift 180 degrees, so the North becomes the South Pole, South becomes the North Pole. And there's lots of animals that live right through that event. Obviously, there's a Far Side cartoon in there somewhere of, you know, they say birds... Birds use stars for navigation, but there was some idea that maybe they have some magnetic particles in their brains, you know, and they're flying along and the Earth's pole shifts and like, what's going on? I thought we were going north. The kind of evidence that they're finding for the extinction of the dinosaurs is the first bit of evidence was right at the layer below which you find dinosaur bones, above which you don't. Was an increase in an element called iridium, very rare in our planet, very common in meteorites. And this has been found in probably 100 different locations around the Earth. At that same layer, increases in iridium. There's also a certain type of smashed quartz grains that can only be made under enormously high pressures that don't exist on this planet except when meteorites hit. You go to known meteorite, like the Barringer Crater in Arizona, we know a meteor hit there, and you look around and you can find this kind of smashed quartz. You can't find it really anywhere else. And you find that at that layer. There is soot, black stuff at that layer. They suggest that there were worldwide fires at that time. Just kind of In fact, the scenario that geologists came up with for that particular event was adopted by the people that talked about what nuclear winter would be like if we had a nuclear holocaust. They used what was found in the geologic record as a model for what nuclear winter would be like.
How big was the meteor?
They've estimated that. I think it was like 6-10 kilometers across. Have you heard something like that, Rudy, or Tom?
Somewhere between 10 and 100 kilometers across.
Okay. Big. And there's also some evidence that there might have been more than one. There's one, like I said, I think they found in the Yucatan. There's one in Iowa. Finally, something Iowa can be noted for. I believe so, yes. Mm-hmm. So it was worldwide. It wasn't just the smash of the meteor that killed them. It was the ensuing ecological disaster that happened. I mean, it threw up an enormous amount of earth material in the air, which would have blocked out the sun, would have hung out in the atmosphere for several years. And, you know, if you go through a year without sun, those things that rely on photosynthesis, they're kind of out of it. So a whole chain of events. Always at the time. Yeah.
In terms of this theory that, you know, the Earth wants, I mean, the universe wants consciousness, yeah. And maybe...
I should say that this is kind of a poetic interpretation on my part and the part of some people. A scientist can't go out and measure an atom and say, oh, it wants to be alive.
And the idea of us enjoying the role of engineer?
I don't know. I'm not aware of that. Maybe somebody knows something about that. I know that a lot of people that talk about the nature of things today talk about the discoveries in physics.
Well, quantum physics, the idea that your matter and energy are intertwined.
Are the same thing.
And one of the theories is that the reason why they're the same thing, that they collapse into forms, has to do with consciousness, whatever that is. Mm. And it has all sorts of religious overtones. And I was just wondering the poetic image there of any geologist.
Well, there's...
kind of thing, since it, there yeah. is only
There was a French paleontologist named Teilhard de Chardin.
Yes.
Yeah. Who's I don't know what paleontology he did, but he's written several books on the kind of coevolution of matter and spirit, that as you make more and more complex organisms, you also complex the spiritual stuff, and that he would say that evolution is progressive. And that we're headed towards some omega point where we have a reunion with the Creator, with God.
Others might reflect that we are more of a connectedness too, mm-hmm. because of this dynamic. Mm-hmm.
What are the thoughts in geological circles about UFOs and space creation?
Well, I think most of those, most geologists don't pay any attention to, because to be a scientist, there has to be some agreement on what you base your theories. If I identify this rock as having some quartz in it, Rudy and Tom are going to have to agree that, oh yeah, that's quartz. We'll agree on that. It's. I don't want to portray science as dog-eat-dog, but one of the greatest things in science is if you can come and disprove somebody. And if somebody has worked up this great theory and you can come in and knock it down. I mean, this theory of the meteors killing the dinosaurs, I mean, that had everybody scrambling to go out and, boy, if I could just find this evidence and say that this is impossible, that's going to be great. So there's a bunch of people eager to know about this stuff, but kind of it's a competitive thing a little bit. And the problems with UFOs is that it's just, it seems so, the data is so, somebody has this fuzzy photograph, you know, or these, it's not the kind of repeatable or the kind of discoverable data that a scientist would trust. And I think really as a scientist, I would say, well, I can't say yes or no. I just don't have enough to say yes or no. I choose probably not to believe them. I think most people that see UFOs want to see UFOs. They want to see UFOs. Yeah, I don't need to see them. You have to talk to you later. Thank you.